WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
When I take a walk, I often ignore the things around me that I consider dull and boring, like telephone poles, parking meters, and parking lots. Those are just the kinds of details that John Stilgo finds fascinating. He thinks that by observing the ordinary things we take for granted in our surroundings, we can learn fascinating details about our environment. Stilgo is a professor of landscape history at Harvard. He teaches his students how to be mindful of their surroundings and the pleasures that mindfulness can bring. He's written a new book called Outside Lies Magic, Regaining History and Awareness in Everyday Places. Here's how he describes his approach to helping people observe the world around them.
What I try to do is to first help people simply go for a walk, not for the physical reasons, not, you know, to lose weight, improve one's heart rate or something, but to go for the walk simply to look around them. And then later, after they start noticing stuff, to trust themselves to figure out what the patterns are. The pattern can be anything from finally noticing that every utility pole in America has a number nailed on it, fixed to it somehow, and one can locate oneself in space by simply, you know, saying, oh, I'm next to pole number 371 on such a street or something. One notices the patterns, one figures things out for oneself, and it's something one always has. It never devalues. To be an acute observer of the world around one, I think, pays tremendous dividends in all sorts of ways.
I'm glad you mentioned telephone poles, because you have a fascinating chapter just all about them. I think we all grew up just taking them for granted that there's wooden poles with wires strung on them. When did they first come into being, and why wooden poles?
Well, wooden poles came into being much earlier than electric service. They came into being with the invention of the telegraph. And they came, the reason they're wood, they were wood, and they're still wood, is that we're still a developing nation. We have a tremendous expanse of territory to carry wires across, and the utility companies don't have the money to put up steel or concrete poles all across rural America, even in suburbs. My interest in utility poles dates actually to not only my own curiosity about why we don't look up at them, why we don't really see them, although they're almost everywhere, and they're very rarely vertical. They're usually out of plumb by a little bit because of the stresses of the lines they carry. But the deeper issue is that in the 1910 to maybe 1940 period, a great many critical people, very thoughtful people indeed, realized that this was a huge spider web being dropped down over the American public, that it trapped one into using something that was surely an advantage by almost everybody's standards, but required a monthly payment. So the first real discussion of a web across the United States was in a much earlier period.
You know, you point out that cable TV wires are being strung on old poles that weren't designed for them. And the wire that goes into your home if you live in a neighborhood, they're so sloppily hung often. And I just thought, I'd never thought of that as like a national pattern, but I guess it is.
Well, it's the kind of thing one notices if one goes out for a walk, because eventually if one looks up with no knowledge of electrical engineering at all and simply looks up in the air for a few minutes, one begins to figure out, you know, which are the electric company wires, which are the phone company wires, and which are the cable TV wires. And the cable TV wires are the ones lowest on the pole almost invariably. The cable invention came much later. And now what I'm noticing is that with the tremendous demand for internet service, the phone companies are having to restring cables to bring more lines down streets. And all of this goes on slightly up above the level at which most Americans look. And if one does look up there, one not only sees the wires, one sees the crowns of trees, one sees the birds flying among the wires, and the way on a winter morning, lines of birds will sit on electric lines to warm their feet.
Is that why they do it?
Yes, there's a certain amount of resistance to transmitting the electricity, and the resistance, I don't know how to put it exactly, manifests itself as heat. And the birds sit on the electric lines, warm their feet, their legs, I suppose their stomachs, but they'll just all line up. And they seem to sit on different lines. They seem to sit on lines, how should I put it, that they know about. When I go to work, I've noticed that there's one particular line that always has birds on it on a winter morning, and the lines all around it in the neighborhood never do.
My guest is John Stilgo. He's a Harvard professor and author of the new book, Outside Lies Magic, Regaining History and Awareness in Everyday Places. Now, I know one of the things that you recommend that we all try to do is to follow the tracks of abandoned railroads, commuter lines. What's interesting about that?
Well, many of these lines have been made into pedestrian paths or bike paths, and I think they don't get nearly the use they should. But the significance for me is that if one walks down them with an open mind, not for physical exercise alone, but for a little bit of mental gymnastics, one begins to realize that these lines often are much more direct than the highways that replace them. And now what I find in many places in the United States, if I walk, is that on these abandoned lines, is that there are the first very faint signs that they might be reactivated. And I began, the only reason I stumbled into this is I walked along railroad lines, and I began to notice every now and then, maybe on the side of the line, there'd be an orange-painted surveyor stake. And I started to realize that, you know, deep money real estate investors have begun to realize that, you know, there was a station here once before. It's long gone. But if this railroad track comes back, this is going to be a very valuable piece of property. They buy it. They pay taxes on the woods, the half-abandoned vacant lot, and they wait. And now sometimes I've, you know, seen the first evidence of the surveyor's sign, the stakes and so on, being put out by people who have been hired by the various, you know, state and local governments to see about bringing the trains back. This is only an example of what I try to explain to my readers, that if they would go out and look around, they'd often see the signs of things that are coming that haven't been reported in the newspaper, they haven't been reported by other news media at all. But the first little glimmerings are there in the landscape of change.
I wonder if you've spent a lot of time observing the areas around airports. I think a typical experience that certainly people in Northeast cities have is that you come back from a vacation in a beautiful place, you land at the airport in your Northeast city, and you drive away from the airport and you're surrounded by gas tanks and sewage plants and automobile junkyards, and suddenly you're in this kind of like industrial ugliness.
I have studied this. And the reason for that is, first, the noise of the airplanes, which causes the real estate to be poorly valued. And secondly, the early 20th century belief that you didn't want to locate a business near an airport because the flying machine was bound to land on it and, you know, destroy it. So what we have now are areas of the typical American city that in which most of the urban residents don't go to, and they go through only, as you correctly point out, to get to the airport. The airplane traveler has a real jolt. I mean, as you point out, it's bad enough to come into the airport and see the industrial zone around it. It's much worse when one has been on vacation in a beautiful place. And I do encourage people to walk or bicycle through these great industrial areas, first because they are the public property. It is often where the sewage disposal area is and so on. But if you don't know about them, you don't know about the opportunities that exist in them. If one goes and looks at these places, one finds that very frequently there are struggling retail businesses in the middle of them where one can get a very good deal on anything from automobile tires to furniture imported from South America. But we tend not to think about ever going to one of these neighborhoods for pleasure.
I have one last question for you. You are so keen in your observations about your environments. You've been in the studio of WBUR recording this interview. Did you notice anything that piques your curiosity?
Radio station engineers have frightful posture. I think it's because they're slouched over these controls all the time, and they're in chairs that are not very well-made chairs. I mean, if I were going to sit all day, I'd get a chair as comfortable as they provide the guest, but they don't provide a chair as comfortable for the engineer who's in it. And that's where I'd make my first improvement here. I'd get these guys better chairs, and then they wouldn't be, I think, slouching. I see a thumb being raised behind the glass.
Our engineer is smiling, too. Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Stilgoe is the author of the book Outside Lies Magic. He's a professor of landscape history at Harvard.